Welcome to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thanks for tuning in. We have a collection of articles today, including a piece from Milwaukee about a bill intended to end the disparity between how long-term disability insurance carriers treat mental and physical conditions. We'll be reading a piece from NPR addressing the ripple effects of cuts to federal funding research, as well as a story from The Guardian about an app that helps cricket fans find their way around Lord's Cricket Ground in London. We'll hear a piece describing the positive effects of advocacy from the Braille Monitor. And since July is Disability Pride Month, we'll start with this item from The Arc: Why and How We Celebrate Disability Pride Month, published May 19, 2025. Disability Pride Month is a time to recognize the history, achievements, experiences, and struggles of people with disabilities. It affirms that disability is a natural and valuable part of human diversity, not a deficit or a condition to be fixed. More than one in four adults in the United States, over 70 million people, have a disability. This month calls on everyone to promote inclusion and ensure people with disabilities are accepted exactly as they are, without conditions. What is Disability Pride Month? Disability Pride Month is an annual observance in July that celebrates people with disabilities, commemorates the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, and promotes disability culture and visibility. Observed every July, Disability Pride Month recognizes the importance of the ADA, which was signed into law on July 26, 1990. It highlights disability culture, history, and community pride. This month challenges the harmful idea that people with disabilities need to conform to norms to live meaningful lives. Their lives are just as full, valuable, and worthy of respect, no more, no less. The first Disability Pride celebration was a Disability Pride Day that took place in Boston in 1990. Chicago hosted the first Disability Pride Parade in 2004. Now there are events nationwide empowering people with disabilities to take pride in who they are. Here's more about the history of Disability Pride Month and the story behind the flag. 2025 theme: We Belong Here and We're Here to Stay. The ARC's National Council of Self-Advocates selected the 2025 Disability Pride Month theme, We Belong Here and We're Here to Stay. It delivers a powerful message. People with disabilities are a vital part of every community. Not someday, not conditionally, now. As disability rights face growing threats in education, employment, healthcare, and public life, this year's theme is a clear call to action. It pushes back against ableism, discrimination and bias against people with disabilities, and exclusion. It reminds us that people with disabilities will not be erased, ignored, or pushed aside. Why celebrate Disability Pride Month? Many people with disabilities still face barriers to being fully included and valued. Ableism is often ignored, but its effects are real. It limits access to education, jobs, health care, and respect. Disability Pride Month challenges that. At its core, disability pride is about being accepted on our own terms. It says disability is not something to hide or fix. It's part of who we are. Everyone deserves inclusion, rights, and respect without having to earn them. How to celebrate Disability Pride Month? Ways to connect with people with disabilities. Spend time learning from people with disabilities in real life and online. Visit the ARC's Story Hub and Instagram Reels to hear directly from people with disabilities sharing their experiences. Watch for disability-led stories in the news, like these features from Good Housekeeping, USA Today, and PBS NewsHour. In everyday life, just say hi. Representation and connection start with visibility and respect. How to learn disability history and culture. Understand the roots and the richness of disability pride by diving into disability history, rights movements, and cultural contributions. Learn about key moments in the disability rights movement from UC Berkeley's archive and the ARC's history. Learn from people with disabilities through media like Crip Camp, CODA, Demystifying Disability, and Disability Visibility. Follow disabled activists on social media and listen to what they share, not just during Disability Pride Month, but year-round. How to advocate for disability rights and inclusion. Disability rights are under attack, from cuts to Medicaid and Social Security, to threats against IDEA, Section 504, and a resurgence of the R word. Here's how you can show up and make a difference. Email your elected officials. Tell them disability rights are non-negotiable. Donate to the ARC and other organizations led by and for people with disabilities. Talk to disabled people in your community. Ask what matters most and back them up. Wear your support. Gear from the ARC's online store sparks conversations and shows pride. Challenge ableism. Push back on harmful language and outdated thinking every time you encounter it. Teach the next generation. Use age-appropriate tools from Today.com, HuffPost, and Cincinnati Children's. Share your disability story. What are you proud of? What do you want other people to know? Share your videos, pictures, or written answers on your favorite social media platform using hashtags, hashtag Disability Pride, and hashtag Disability Pride Month. We want as many people to join the conversation as possible. See what the ARCS community has to say by finding us on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and X, Twitter. All content shared by the ARC includes alt text and accessible captions. This reinforces our commitments to accessibility. We hope you will do it too. Attend a Disability Pride Month event in your area. Meet and show your support for the disability community by attending an event in your community. Now here's a story from NPR entitled, She Hoped Key Research Could Help Save Her Eyesight. Then the Trump funding cuts came. This was published June 24, 2025, written by Craig LaMolt. Jessica Chaikoff and her older sister Rachel were both born deaf. At the time, the family didn't know exactly why. The girls began using cochlear implants and carried on. And so we pretty much lived our lives normally, Chaikoff says. But in 2006, when Chaikoff was 11 years old, her older sister started having vision problems and was diagnosed with Usher syndrome type 1F. It's a rare genetic disorder that causes deafness at birth and then, over time, blindness. My mom didn't want to scare me, but they knew if Rachel had it, I have to have it too, because it's genetic, she recalls. Chaikoff's now 30 years old and a PhD student at Brandeis University in the Social Policy Program, where she focuses on disability and higher education policy. And she gets around, especially at night, with the help of a guide dog, a yellow lab named Jig. Chaikoff is hoping research into gene therapies could someday stop or even reverse the deterioration of her vision. but she worries that cuts to federal research funding, especially at Harvard, could mean that therapy won't be ready in time to save her sight. "I don't want to go blind," Chaikoff says, "and so that progression is really scary, especially when I see the cuts by the Trump administration on research funding." A federal judge's ruling this week that funding should be restored for about 800 terminated NIH grants does not include the widespread cancellation of grants at Harvard University. This means that more than $1 billion from the National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation that were awarded to Harvard but have yet to have been spent are now unavailable. The Trump administration has said the termination of Harvard's grants are in part because of what it sees as the university's failure to address anti-Semitism on campus. USHER 1F, which is thought to affect somewhere around 10 to 20 infants born in the U.S. each year, is particularly prevalent in people descended from Ashkenazi Jewish populations. "I get really angry because the Trump administration claims they're protecting us. They're not," says Chaikoff. "They're actively harming us, especially when you're attacking funds for Ashkenazi Jews, Jewish diseases." Chaikoff's parents run a foundation called the USHER 1F Collaborative, which is dedicated to supporting the development of gene therapies for USHER 1F. In 2017, Dr. David Corey, a Harvard scientist who'd been studying the protein that's affected in these patients, met Jessica and her sister at a conference hosted by the foundation. And it was really meeting the two daughters and seeing how well they're bearing up with the challenges of the disease that we said, you know, we might be able to contribute something here. If we don't, who else is going to do it? Corey says. They now have a good understanding of the protein that's defective in patients with USHER 1F, Corey says. "Because we know so much about it, we could design strategies to deliver a normal copy of this protein, first to the inner ear and then to the retina," he says. "It's going to take more research before they're ready to begin human trials of a gene therapy that could fix that protein in patients," Corey says. There are no existing grants to Harvard pertaining specifically to USHER 1F, and so the cancellations haven't yet directly impacted the research. But Corey says he has two grant applications submitted to the National Institutes of Health, and he's not optimistic about their approval. But even if they are scored very highly by a review committee, it's unlikely that those grants would ever be awarded to Harvard, he says. That will really slow down the research. Already, some of his research has come to a halt. Corey had an NIH grant terminated that was supporting basic science into the genetic mechanism of hearing. The NIH did not respond to a request for comment. To be on the verge of developing therapies finally for some diseases that we could only diagnose for decades, and then to have the rug pulled out from under us, for the whole scientific enterprise, not just Harvard, is really discouraging, Corey says. Even so, Corey said he's optimistic Harvard's lawsuit challenging the federal funding freeze will be successful. He says when that happens, his grant applications will be there, ready for funding. Jessica Chaikoff is hoping he's right. She's confident gene therapies could work. "And that's the case, not just for my disease, but for any rare disease," Chaikoff says. "As long," she says, "as the federal funding is available." And now a piece from the June edition of the Braille Monitor entitled, "A Handful of Blind Little Boys and Girls from Tennessee Just Beat the Speaker of the House," by James Brown. From the editor. James Brown is president of the National Federation of the Blind, Tennessee. He's also known to the Federationists for his composition and recording of some of our newest movement songs, including Live the Life You Want. His day job is as a transportation program supervisor with the Tennessee Department of Transportation. As you will read in this article, Advocacy gives him great joy, even or perhaps especially when the stakes are high, and he writes about it with wit and verve. All too often, members of the public, including legislators, view blind people as powerless children to be patronized or, worse, ignored. But we are not children, and we are not powerless, as James and his Tennessee Federation family recently demonstrated. Here is how James tells the story. The spark. I still remember the first time I felt the spark, that electric sense that maybe, just maybe, we really could change things. It was 2009, and I had just landed in Washington, D.C. to attend my very first Washington seminar with the National Federation of the Blind. There were only three of us from Tennessee that year. We were small in number and passionate. In fact, I was so green, I didn't know the difference between a House resolution and a Krispy Kreme donut. Thankfully, I was paired with Joe Shaw, a seasoned legislative advocate and a blind vendor with a sharp wit and a deep knowledge of the Hill. Within the first hour of our legislative meetings, a legislative aide leaned across the table and asked, "Are you two professional lobbyists?" I couldn't believe it. I was a total rookie, and here someone thought we were pros. Joe just laughed and said, "Well, we do know our way around the issues." Not bad for day one. Well, that year, we were promoting the Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act, a piece of legislation to make sure hybrid and electric vehicles made enough sound so blind pedestrians like me didn't end up playing real-life Frogger just trying to cross the street. The bill passed less than 2 years later, and I was hooked. Since then, the National Federation of the Blind, Tennessee, has worked on state legislation to protect the rights of blind parents, ensuring our kids don't get taken away just because we have a disability. We've helped pass a law requiring Tennessee's higher education system to follow accessibility standards for digital content. We abolished subminimum wages for workers with disabilities. We even got legislation passed to make prescription labels accessible to blind and low-vision people. Most of our work has been about building something, creating opportunity, removing barriers, opening doors. But every now and then, a bill comes along that doesn't just block the door. It threatens to bulldoze the whole building. And when that happens, you don't push forward. You dig in. That moment came in April of 2025 when a poison pill amendment to eliminate Tennessee's Little Randolph-Shepard Act was proposed 16 hours before the bill and amendment were about to be heard on the floor of the Tennessee House of Representatives. Like the federal Randolph-Shepard Act, Little Randolph-Shepard Acts in states across our nation provide opportunities for blind people to operate small businesses in state buildings. The amendment would have erased around 300 jobs, many of them held by our blind brothers and sisters. Blind, but not backing down. Once we, in a frenzy, got the bill rolled for a one-week delay, we hit the ground running, and we didn't stop. Within hours, Terry Smith from the National Association of Blind Merchants, a division of the National Federation of the Blind, was drafting fact sheets and press releases. I was fielding calls from vendors, lawmakers, and federation members across the state. The Tennessee Committee of Blind Vendors also jumped in with both feet, and a statewide strategy started to take shape. We heard from the political grapevine that the bill originally came from the Tennessee Speaker of the House. The clock was ticking and legislators would be leaving town for the weekend before Easter, and by the time Monday morning rolled around, we'd only have three real working days left to shift votes, secure media coverage, and apply pressure. There was no time to waste. Funny how life circles back sometimes. Joe Shaw, from back in 2009, was now right back in the trenches with me. Only this time, it was our own backyard. Joe and his wife Karen started early Monday morning visiting all 99 members of the Tennessee House of Representatives. they handed out fact sheets, scheduled meetings, and personally told our story, one lawmaker and staffer at a time. While they canvassed the Capitol, we launched our media blitz. By Sunday night, we'd let the proverbial cat out of the bag. Press releases went out to every major outlet in Tennessee, and by Monday afternoon, our first TV story hit the airwaves in Nashville, spotlighting the work of blind vendors across the state and the devastating impact this bill would have. Then came Memphis, then Chattanooga, then Knoxville. Like dominoes, one media market after another picked up the story. Within just a few days, we were in every major market in Tennessee. Inside the Capitol, we stuck to a simple but powerful message. We told lawmakers we loved the Senate version of the bill, which improved customer service and expanded opportunities for all people with disabilities. But the House amendment? That was a poison pill. It didn't expand opportunity, it wiped it out. Of the roughly 90 blind vendors in Tennessee, 80 would lose their jobs. That's not policy, that's carnage. And it wasn't just jobs. These vendors had invested their savings, taken out loans, bought equipment, and built small businesses from the ground up. One vendor in West Tennessee told me he had 3 box trucks tied to his business. If this bill passed, he'd likely lose it all. His trucks, his business, maybe even his home. He said he might have to go on Social Security and move in with family. That's not theoretical. That's real life. By Tuesday night, we had already secured half of the 26 Republican votes we needed to kill the amendment, and the pressure was starting to mount. The media turns up the heat. By Wednesday, April 16, the media machine was in full swing, and it was doing exactly what we needed it to do. The pressure was no longer just coming from inside the Capitol. It was coming from living rooms, smartphones, and kitchen tables across Tennessee. Fox 13 Memphis had been digging into the story, and in their hunt for a quote, they reached out to the sponsor of the House bill, the very one who'd introduced the toxic amendment. But instead of reaching him, they accidentally got his wife. And let's just say she wasn't thrilled about how her husband's legislative season was going. The reporter told us later that the representative might be sleeping on the couch for a while. Now, I don't know what kind of sofa he's got at home, but I hope it's comfy because the media wasn't done yet. His wife ended up giving the reporter his cell phone number, and to his credit, the representative agreed to an interview. He tried to frame the amendment as a way to expand opportunities for people with disabilities. But while he was talking, the news station flashed the actual amendment text across the screen, highlighting the part where blind vendors would be forced to compete with giant corporations. Not exactly the best look. This aired Tuesday night, just days before the bill was scheduled for a vote. At the same time, our team of advocates was still pounding the pavement inside the Capitol. Joe, Karen, members of the Blind Vendor Committee, and Randolph Shepherd Walking Encyclopedia Terry Smith were running from office to office, meeting with legislators, dropping off packets, answering questions, and clarifying what this amendment would really do. By Wednesday afternoon, we started hearing from legislative aides that their representatives were texting them from the House floor. I've decided I'm voting no if that amendment stays in. Others said, I'm hearing it's going to be pulled. It was like watching a wave build, not a tidal wave of destruction, but one of momentum, of clarity, of people standing up and doing the right thing. Still, we couldn't relax. Politics can be a game of misdirection. Until it was official, we had to assume the amendment was still alive and kicking. Victory in the 11th hour. Thursday morning, April 17, arrived like the final lap of the New York City Marathon, hearts racing, shoes worn down, and adrenaline doing all the work. We'd done everything we could. We had flooded inboxes, knocked on doors, given interviews, and practically worn tracks in the carpet of the Capitol. But there was still that flicker of doubt. Was it enough? The bill was scheduled to be heard that morning. We gathered in person on the floor of the House and around our cell phones, our ears tuned to every word coming over the live feed. And then, just like that, it happened. The representative stood up and pulled the amendment. No debate, no vote, just gone. And if that wasn't enough, he followed it up with what may go down in history as the most awkward half-apology in Tennessee legislative history. He said something along the lines of, "This amendment probably wasn't my best idea." Now look, I don't know what prompted his change of heart. Maybe it was the outcry from blind vendors across the state. Maybe it was the press coverage. Maybe it was the overwhelming number of representatives who said they wouldn't support the amendment. Or maybe, just maybe, it was the fact that his wife gave his number to a reporter and told him he'd better fix it before Easter weekend. Whatever the reason, we had done it. We stopped a bill that would have devastated an entire community of blind entrepreneurs in Tennessee. We stared down one of the most powerful figures in state government and came out on top. And we did it with facts, with unity, with persistence, and, yeah, with a little humor, too. By Thursday afternoon, we were breathing for the first time all week. Not celebrating exactly, because there's always another fight around the corner, but smiling, laughing, maybe even letting ourselves feel proud. It wasn't just a policy win. It was proof that advocacy works, that blind people have power, and that a handful of blind little boys and girls from Tennessee can still beat the Speaker of the House. What this win really means. This wasn't just about vending. It wasn't just about a single amendment, or one bad bill, or one week of frantic advocacy. This was about reminding ourselves and reminding the people in power that blind people are not invisible, we are not silent, and we are not weak. We are business owners, advocates, parents, professionals, problem solvers, and when necessary, political warriors. We know how to organize, we know how to mobilize, and when someone threatens our livelihoods, our dignity, or our future, we show up. We show up with facts. We show up with courage. We show up with unity. And yes, we show up with press releases, TV spots, and the occasional well-timed joke about sleeping on the couch. If you're a Federation member reading this, wondering if your voice matters, let me assure you, it does. If you've ever questioned whether one letter, one phone call, or one office visit can make a difference, let this be your proof. If you've ever been discouraged by the political climate or worn down by how long change takes, take heart. Because in 1 week, against long odds, a small team of determined blind advocates in Tennessee protected the rights of 80 blind entrepreneurs and pushed back against the Speaker of the House himself. I hope this story makes you laugh. I hope it makes you think. But most of all, I hope it reminds you that we still have power. The world doesn't hand us victories. We go out and win them with a smile on our face, a white cane in our hand, or in my case, a solid black German shepherd named Zero by my side. Because that's who we are. We are the National Federation of the Blind, and we never stop fighting for each other. Now, the next article comes from The Guardian, and it's entitled, "Amazing for Blind People. App Helps Cricket Fans Find Way Around Lourdes." Wayfinding technology is intended to help partially sighted and disabled fans to better access live sports. Now, before we start into that article, let me remind you that you're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now that piece from The Guardian by Robert Booth, published June 26, 2025. "In 19 feet, turn slightly left," said a robotic voice from the iPhone in Moshfiq Ahmed's hand as he tried to find a seat at Lord's Cricket Ground in London. "Take the stairs," it said, as Ahmed, an England visually impaired cricketer, tapped his white cane on his way towards the Eadridge stand without any other assistance. "There is one landing. Turn to 9 o'clock at the bottom of the stairs. You have arrived at row 5. Ahmed was one of the first people to try new wayfinding technology installed this week at Lourdes to help blind and partially sighted and disabled fans to better access live sports. Waymap, the company behind the app-based navigation tool, claims the 31,000-capacity cricket stadium is the world's first sports arena to be fitted with a personal GPS that aims to offer a fine-grained version of traffic sat-navs for stadiums, shopping centers, and transport networks. Waymap uses a 50,000-pound camera to scan every staircase, walkway, slope, doorway, and concourse to create a digital twin of the historic cricket ground, allowing its app to guide people meter by meter to their destination. It has been installed in advance of next month's England versus India test match. The Marylebone Cricket Club, which runs Lourdes, believes it could also help other cricket fans find the most accessible routes around the complex. "The idea is amazing for blind people," said Ahmed, who tested the app at the Guardian's request after playing in an exhibition match on Wednesday. "If it works 100% properly, I can come to the train station myself, I can cross the road myself, and I can come to the stadium and find my way with the app. I know so many people who are into sports but don't go. This would push the door completely open for them." It was the first time he had used the app, and there were a couple of false starts. It briefly suggested he head in the wrong direction and once directed him towards a staircase that was temporarily closed. It also stopped him at row 20 of the Eadridge stand instead of row 5 as instructed. But the problems appeared to be as much down to the app and the user getting used to each other. For example, the app needs to be calibrated to the individual user's stride pattern, which explained why it had directed him to the wrong row. "It needs to be accurate and trustworthy," said Ahmed, who lost most of his eyesight in 2017. Kelso Zuccolo, the chief executive at Waymap, said, "Waymap is a new way of navigating. It usually takes a few walks for new users to learn how to use the app most effectively and for it to learn your walking style. The more you use it, the better it gets. The goal would be to extend it to places like Wembley, football stadiums, and cricket stadiums, and we're in talks with horse racing tracks," he said, adding that property managers could update the maps in real time if food trucks were positioned in different areas or certain pathways were closed. The app, which is already available for users of the public transit system in Washington, D.C., does not alert the partially sighted user to the movements of other members of the public, particularly those wandering around looking at their phones, whom Ahmed said were still the biggest obstacle to him getting around safely and comfortably. Next, we have a piece from the Washington Post entitled, "I Have an Invisible Disability. Getting Travel Accommodations is Tough. There are ways to get support and make travel easier," experts said. It's published June 27, 2025. Was by Lindsay Karp. "In April, as I stepped onto a cruise ship with my family, I should have been excited. But often, I don't have the luxury of feeling that first moment of vacation bliss. Living with multiple sclerosis, I find walking and standing a burden. And accommodations that would enable me to navigate a vacation with ease have been difficult to get, because my disability is invisible. For many of us in this gray area of disability, this is common. That must change. meeting with resistance. I don't use a wheelchair. I can stand and walk. However, prolonged standing diminishes my strength, leaving me unable to walk afterward. In 2019, I tried to get an accommodation of bypassing lines at ports during a cruise with my husband, but without much success. It was unsettling that receiving an appropriate accommodation could be so challenging. Still, my love of cruises sat in my brain, nudging me every so often. Recently, I began to consider the possibility of trying again. In theory, a cruise should be a good option for those with mobility challenges, and I thought that perhaps the cruise line would be more accommodating now because disability awareness has increased in recent years. With more experience being a self-advocate, I also thought I could now communicate my needs more effectively ahead of time. So, despite the possibility of facing the same challenges, we decided to take our children on their first cruise. I was determined to receive an accommodation in writing before boarding the ship. I wasn't willing to miss the thrill in my children's eyes as they swam in the Caribbean clear water for the first time. I obtained a letter from my neurologist, which was required by the cruise line, filled out the guest special needs form online, and then made several phone calls to the cruise line's accessibility and guest services departments, requesting the ability to bypass lines to exit the ship at ports. This would help conserve my strength, enabling me to walk once on the ground. I was repeatedly told that I could enter and exit the ship via wheelchair on the first and last days, but that no assistance would be provided at ports. Options, including wheelchair peer assistance and wheelchair-accessible vehicles for transfers, are listed on the special guest needs form. However, supports for invisible disabilities, including bypassing lines, are not. Receiving accommodations not listed is nearly impossible. I offered to use a wheelchair to exit the ship at ports, but was told that wheelchairs are not available on board. People can bring their own wheelchairs. However, I don't need one frequently enough to justify purchasing one. I later discovered that wheelchairs can be rented from various companies, including Scoot Around and Special Needs at Sea. But as someone who can walk and chooses to do so as much as possible, traveling with a wheelchair solely for lines isn't feasible, as I would need somewhere to store it once I disembark. It was then suggested that I pay an additional fee for an upgraded package with numerous perks, one of which is expedited disembarkation at ports. But to charge me for an accommodation for my disability is not in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. What worked for me? After many unsuccessful communication attempts using the general email and phone number provided online for the special needs department of the cruise line, I did some research and emailed a specific employee in a lead position within the access department. The department responsible for providing specialized assistance and accommodations for guests with disabilities. It seemed that staff weren't trained to handle these requests. Contacting a specific employee was the step that ultimately made a difference for me. I then received the email I'd been waiting for. My accommodation was finally approved. Traveling with an invisible disability is never simple, but now I knew that receiving the support I needed was possible and that contacting a specific employee could ease the process. But there was no clear way for the crew to be aware of my accommodation. On board, I was initially told to stand in line, and I had to relay my story for what felt like the 100th time. But then, I was introduced to the guest departure officer, the person responsible for ensuring guests can exit the ship with ease. She genuinely wanted to help and said to call the guest services desk when my family was ready to disembark at ports, and she would guide us around the line. Having her contact information allowed me to receive the support I needed to access my vacation in its entirety. The cruise line I traveled with is not alone in its need for improvement in accommodation access. For this reason, I chose not to disclose the company's name in the hope that I may create awareness for change across the board without placing blame. When contacted for comment by the Washington Post, the company acknowledged that it could have handled some things better and said it is committed to improving experiences for travelers. Why receiving accommodations can be a challenge. About 80% of people with disabilities have an invisible disability, said Wayne Connell, founder, president, and chief executive of the Invisible Disabilities Association, IDA. It's the invisible nature of the disability or illness that often leads to disbelief and misunderstanding about what help they may need or if they need any help at all. Tiffany Yu, author of The Anti-Ableist Manifesto and founder of Diversability, a community of people with disabilities and their supporters, with the mission of elevating disability pride, understands the challenges I and many others face when trying to get accommodations. We presume non-disability unless someone proves otherwise, and even then, people often have to disclose personal, medical, and traumatic information to receive basic support, she said. Disclosure shouldn't be a prerequisite for dignity. It's a problem of assumption over accommodation, and it forces people to over-explain or justify their needs, which can be exhausting and demoralizing, Yu said. Tips for people with disabilities. People with disabilities deserve to travel with ease, and there are ways to make it feasible. Traveling with an invisible disability requires lots of planning and prep, Connell said. Contact the transportation company, whether it be a cruise line, train, bus, or limo service, ahead of time, and ask for a contact person who can help on the day of travel, Connell recommends. Before air travel, call the airline and airport to provide any details needed to facilitate a smooth check-in and flight, he said. From mapping out restroom or quiet lounge locations to ensuring wheelchair availability or establishing care for a service animal, there are many details travelers may need to consider, Connell said. You advised focusing on the barriers you are experiencing and what you need to address them. For example, you could say, I have a disability that impacts my energy levels and stress responses. Here's what I need to make this experience more accessible, she suggested. You also said that while you shouldn't have to prove your disability, a doctor's note or travel letter may allow for a smoother process. Through the IDA, the National Disability ID Initiative is pursuing legislation that would enable voluntary disclosure of disabilities on state government-issued driver's licenses and IDs. While only offered in Alaska, Colorado, and Utah, personalized disability ID cards sold by the IDA provide visual recognition of a disability and the possible need for accommodations. Connell said the IDs signal that the disabilities are real even if you can't see them. How we can increase accommodation access. For everyone living with an invisible disability, changing the atmosphere around accommodation access is essential. The first step is believing disabled people when they advocate for their access needs, Yu said. Accessibility should also be built into our lives so that it's not something we need to request, explain, or justify. This might include sensory-friendly options or the ability to opt out of physically demanding activities, she said. Education is another vital piece of the solution. Organizations across industries, including travel and hospitality, should proactively train their staff to understand the spectrum of disability and to respond with empathy and flexibility, you said. When more people understand that disability isn't a monolith, we create a culture where accommodations aren't questioned, they're expected. Finally, policies that support travelers with disabilities need increased visibility, you said. An accessible and anti-ableist approach would include clear information, low barrier process for requesting accommodations, and staff trained to handle those requests with care and respect, she said. Support for those with invisible disabilities can and should become commonplace. Only then can we feel that first moment of vacation bliss, too. And now we have a piece from WBKO News in Bowling Green, Kentucky, entitled, 8-Year-Old Girl Overcomes Physical Disability to Become Soapbox Racer, by Adam Ferguson, published June 26, 2025. Bowling Green, Kentucky. An 8-year-old girl is proving that no obstacle is too big when there's a dream to race. Born with a physical disability that left her with legs that didn't develop below the knee, 8-year-old Gabby Bilbray dreamed of racing her own vehicle in the Bowling Green Kiwanis Club Soapbox Derby. In 2024, Gabby had her first taste of competition when she was allowed to ride as a second in the two-manned vehicle competition. "I've done it last year, and I felt I did pretty good," Gabby said. "I'd like to maybe do it on my own. Last year, somebody drove it for me, so I didn't drive it." Gabby was determined not to be a passenger again in 2025, and so her family and Kiwanin David Holland worked for weeks to build a soapbox car that would allow her to race. "The brake is different, and it's not like a switch," Gabby said. "We used to have one of the ones where I pull, but I just wasn't strong enough to brake." Traditionally, soapbox derby cars have a foot pedal braking system, but an entirely different style of brakes had to be used in order to allow Gabby to safely stop the vehicle at the finish line. "It has a pneumatic cylinder that activates the brake, as opposed to a handbrake like we tried before," explained Gabby's father, Travis Bilbray. The pneumatic brakes allowed Gabby to live out her dream while still racing a competition-legal vehicle. "It's a great thing because it puts Gabby on the same level playing field as other kids her age, so we can compete at the same activities and at the same level that they do," Travis Bilbray said. "It's really great to see her take the initiative to want to do things on her own and have that drive to overcome those obstacles." Up next from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Congress takes first step toward equal coverage of mental, physical disability coverage, by Natalie Elbert, published June 26, 2025. A bill introduced in Congress this month would end the disparity in how long-term disability insurance carriers treat physical conditions and mental conditions or substance abuse disorders. Today, jobs with long-term disability benefits typically provide insurance coverage for physical ailments until retirement age. However, no matter how severe or persistent the mental illness is, how debilitating the PTSD, or how difficult the addiction recovery, virtually every U.S. insurer cuts the coverage after 24 months. The Workers' Disability Benefits Parity Act, introduced by U.S. Representatives Mark DeSaulnier, a California Democrat, and Bobby Scott, a Virginia Democrat, would end that practice, which is known in some company plans as mental nervous limitation. The legislation comes a year and a half after a landmark report from the Advisory Council on Employee Welfare and Pension Benefit Plans concluded that duration limits for mental health and substance use disorders are discriminatory. The council is known as the ERISA Council, named for the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, the federal tax and labor law that, 51 years ago, set standards for employee benefit plans. Its 61-page report in December 2023 recommended the Department of Labor promote the elimination of the 24-month limitations. These limitations have devastated Wisconsin employees. A series of investigations by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found people who lost their jobs, houses, support systems, and sense of hope and ambition due to losing coverage they thought was guaranteed. Many remained sick and in need of treatment as they attempted to fight legal battles with well-resourced insurance companies. While behavioral health disabilities make up just 7-8% of all disability claims, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found more than one-third of all disability lawsuits in Wisconsin challenged claims for mental health coverage that had been denied. In every case, the investigation found, the insurer's evidence of denial contradicted rigorous psychological evaluations and provider recommendations from the employee's health team. Often, insurance companies offered incentives to in-house or third-party medical reviewers to deny claims. The reviewers almost never had direct interaction with the Wisconsin residents for whom they denied care. Some were no longer actively practicing health care. Some did not even specialize in the field they were reviewing. The investigation won second place in the 2024 Catherine Schneider Journalism Award for Excellence in Reporting on Disability, administered by the National Center on Disability and Journalism. The reporting was made possible through a grant from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2024 National Fellowship Fund. Should the bill become law, the Workers' Disability Benefits Act would do the following: amend the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA, to require private disability benefit plans comply with behavioral health parity, establish behavioral health parity for disability insurance and for employee benefit plans sponsored by state and local governments, require the Department of Labor to implement other recommendations of the ERISA Advisory Council, authorize funding for the Department of Labor to implement those requirements. Workers needing more than 24 months are rare. Jessa Victor, a shareholder at Hawks Quindell Law Firm in Madison, who has litigated hundreds of disability cases, said the bill, if passed, would be life-saving. That's not me being dramatic either, especially in this day and age where other public resources and support agencies are having funding cuts, Victor said. A lot of people are coming to rely more and more on their long-term disability benefits. That especially extends to individuals who are also applying for Social Security and experiencing significantly longer wait times, Victor said. Under the Trump administration, the Social Security Administration announced it would be slashing 12% of its staff to reduce the size of its bloated workforce and organizational structure, the agency said in a February blog post. Victor has seen what happens when benefits run out. She's had clients file for bankruptcy, and some end up homeless because they can't go back to work. At the same time, the insurance is acknowledging they're still totally disabled and completely unable to work. But because you hit 24 months, your benefits are done, she said. Most people who struggle with behavioral health conditions don't need the full 24 months of coverage, Victor emphasized, but it's a significant benefit for those who do. That was also one of the conclusions the ERISA Advisory Group argued in terms of cost concerns for insurance companies. Those who do need long-term coverage represent a small percentage of claimants. Dr. Dan Fishbein, president of Sun Life U.S., released a press release June 5th congratulating DeSaulnier and Scott for introducing the bill, a move he called on Congress to do in 2023 following the ERISA advisory report. Sun Life US is the only disability insurer so far to promote the legislation, citing a need for equitable treatment of behavioral health. Fishbein told the Journal Sentinel the cost of disability parity would be worthwhile for disability insurers, not just because only a small percentage of employees take more than 24 months for behavioral health treatment, but it ultimately makes for a healthier workforce. Workers who cannot be successful at work because of a mental health diagnosis would get the time and support needed in order to get back to work and return as productive workers, Fishbein said. Employers would get something significant in return for providing a somewhat enhanced disability benefits program. Most insurance companies have robust programs to help people with physical disabilities get back to work, which sometimes looks like physical therapy, making sure they're getting the right medical care, and coordinating with the employer to help them return to work. There isn't anything like that for people with disabling behavioral health disorders. Often, as a person on disability for mental health-related issues approaches the 24-month benefit limit, their benefit gets recategorized as a physical diagnosis, said Fishbein. That person isn't directed to the right support networks, Fishbein said, because the benefits are just going to run out. When I talk to our clinicians who work on these claims, they readily admit they don't focus on clients with mental health conditions, Fishbein said. We would much rather our clinical programs be applied to help people recover and get back to work. Right now, we're managing the benefit, but we'd much rather help people manage the condition. That concludes our program for this time. We appreciate you tuning in to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds. We hope you'll join us again next time, and we hope you'll continue enjoying the many fine programs on Sun Sounds.